I thank you all for coming, and I'm sorry that I'm late, but my driver doesn't know the area, and neither do I, so there was nothing I could do about it. But we made it. I thank Venkat Bhatta for the nice introduction, but please believe me, from the beginning I'm nothing special, but I have been practicing Krishna consciousness, practicing bhakti yoga for almost 36 years now. I joined this movement when I was 19 actually, just about at the inception of our Krishna conscious movement in America. Our spiritual teacher, the founder of this movement, affectionately we call him Srila Prabhupada, it means a great master, he came from India in 1965 to the West on the order of his teacher to share this great spiritual tradition with the people of America to begin with. And soon after I joined, Prabhupada sent me to Europe to help pioneer the movement there, and from there I went to Russia and China, and now as a traveling monk I travel all over the world. I usually circle the globe twice or thrice during the year. And I'm seeing that although we had a very humble beginning, one saintly person coming to America bearing on his shoulders a great spiritual tradition, our movement has blossomed all over the world. And I think that is due in part because it's authorized. It's based on a very ancient scripture. We don't have the whole book here, we just have the introduction. Bhagavad Gita. I think some of you must have heard of that book, Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad is the name of the Supreme, and Gita means song. So this ancient text, this ancient scripture, was spoken by Lord Krishna when he was present on the planet 5,000 years ago. Bhagavad Gita. Like all the great spiritual traditions of the world, and there are many, to each his own, Bhagavad Gita stresses first and foremost the importance of the human form of life. Interestingly enough, it's also very scientific because it describes in detail the nature of this world and the spiritual world. So Krishna describes that in this material creation, far beyond what where our space travel can take us, there's 8,400,000 species of life. I think our scientists have discovered about 3,200,000 or something. So 8,400,000 species of life. And although a sadhu, a rishi, a yogi in India, he's taught to respect every form of life. He doesn't discriminate. He sees them all equally. He sees them as all created by God, so in that sense, we're all brothers and sisters. But special stress is given to the human form of life because we have what is called buddhi. I'm sure you're all familiar with Buddhism. So Buddha means the enlightened one, one who's used his intelligence for a higher purpose. Actually, God, when he creates all the different species of life, he blesses them each with a little gift, just like your parents. You may have four or five kids in the family, right? You have brothers and sisters. But when it comes time for their birthday, mom and dad acknowledge their birth and give them, you know, a present each one when the birthday comes around. So similarly, Krishna blesses every living entity with something a little unique, a little special. Like birds can fly, much to the envy of man. For us to fly, we have to work hard, many months, wait till spring break, and then fly to Florida or whatever. And fish can swim under the water, no scuba tanks. Bears can sleep 6 months of the year, can you imagine? No one wakes them up for school or go to work. Butterflies are always beautiful. They never have to take off their makeup or put it back on. It's permanently there. Very nice. So what do we get? We got intelligence. Actually, there's so many similarities between all the various species of life. But the one difference between mankind and all other forms of life is our intelligence. And obviously with that intelligence, down through the ages, particularly in the last 300 or 400 years, we've done amazing things. I mean, most recently our, you know, quantum leaps in information technology and space travel and medicine and so forth and so on. And that's fine. But really, the ancient sages of India point out that the ultimate purpose of that buddhi, that intelligence, which you are all utilizing to the max now in school, is to discover one's deeper spiritual nature. It takes a little intelligence to go within and discover your real self. Animals can't do it. Their intelligence is limited. They're just eating, sleeping, mating, and fighting, and all different, eating. Never stop and think, who am I? Where have I come from? I want to be happy in this world, but there's just so many obstacles, so much stress and things. One day I'm going to die, what happens? You know, is there a supreme, is there an absolute truth? Maybe there is, maybe there isn't at the onset when you're starting. But at least you have the ability to inquire. So our intelligence should be used for that purpose as well. We say to look within, or the science of self-realization. And that's the first step in the science of self-realization. It's the first subject matter that Krishna discusses in this ancient book, Bhagavad Gita, which is now popular not only in India, but all over the world. Because that goal in life is not just for the people of India, but the whole world. So why have many of us, as Westerners, turn to the East to answer those questions? There's a wealth of knowledge in Western society, in their philosophy class, in the Judeo-Christian tradition. This is a subject matter which is prominent in that field as well. Why? Well, if you could make a comparative study of Bhagavad Gita and the Bible and the Quran and the Torah and the Lotus Sutras of Buddha, you would find there's a central theme running through all of them. But there's different evolutions of knowledge, just like school. You know, when you were 6 years old, 1 + 1 = 2, you were in grade school. And then you go to high school, and then you go to university, and then you'll do your PhD program. You're studying the same thing, but different levels of knowledge. So different spiritual traditions take you to different levels of understanding. That doesn't mean one's better than the other. Doesn't mean your school's better than the high school down the road or the grade school. It's just where you're at. You're looking for something more profound. So our very humble proposition is that the teachings of the East, they go into great depth into the subject matter. Let's just take one question. Who am I? Krishna begins to explain in the Bhagavad Gita, second chapter, in a very interesting way. Who am I? He says, first of all, you're not this body. When you get up in the morning and look in the mirror, right, the boys are like, I can't do it anymore. It goes down that way, and I used to go up when I was young. And the girls, I don't have a clue, but something like that. Ooh, nice, or something. Or if there's a pimple. But actually, we're thinking that's who we are. But actually, that couldn't be further from the truth. The body, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna describes the body as yantra. It means a very sophisticated machine. I know it sounds pretty revolutionary, but a very sophisticated machine, more sophisticated than anything science has produced, made of material energy. And, you know, doctors, they can attest to the fact that you change the parts, you know, not all the parts, but, you know. But it's a machine made of material energy, and within the machine is a force, an energy, We say in Sanskrit, Atma, or soul. And it's that spark of life that gives the semblance of life to this body. Just like a puppet. You have a puppet, and you got a puppeteer, so he's moving it around like this and everything. And little kid's thinking, oh, mommy, the puppet's alive. Mommy's thinking, no, darling, it's just, you'll understand when you grow up. Something's inside moving. That's a very gross example. But the body's like that. It's a machine which is manipulated by the soul within. The body doesn't have life. You look at the skin, you look at the flesh underneath, the blood vessels, whatever else, and I've never looked inside with this. Where's the life? It's made of matter. And matter doesn't have life. You look around this room, there's so many material things, but none of them are conscious, none of them are living. Matter doesn't have life. And this body is made of the same elements that constitute anything else in this room. It's just the chemicals are arranged in a different way. They don't have life. Of course, science, you learn in biology that life comes from matter, that if there's the right atmospheric conditions and the right chemicals are there and they move around, then poof, you've got life. That's Darwinian evolution. It all began in a pool somewhere. An electric bolt came from the sky, zap, and the chemicals were there, and it put them in the right combination. Boom, here I am. Hi. And there's nobody else, so we split into two, male and female. I'm ridiculing it because actually it's not a fact that life comes from matter. The sciences have never taken material elements and made life. It's a theory. It's not a fact. They've never taken chemicals and made life. They're going to do it. But that's like, you know, me writing you a post-dated check. $1 million, July 1st, 3010. So the body doesn't have life. It's made of matter. It's just the chemicals are arranged in a different way. You know, even in when I was in school, we learned that the body is something like 60% water. So, what gives it the it's the spark. You can call it the force. You can call it the spark of life. You can call it the soul. But that's who you really are. Intuitively, we know that we're not the body. Because when we speak, we say, this is my hand, this is my arm, this is my head, this is my tummy, this is my leg, this is my body. We don't say I hand, I arm. Go back to grade school. We say it's mine, it belongs to me. You see? Intuitively, no, we're not the body. We identified it belongs to me, like this. So that spark of life, it's unknown in Western countries. We're so advanced, but we're kind of like missing the point, we've lost the plot, so to speak. Everything to satisfy the body and very little to go in within and study the soul. We're so interested in going as far as we can in outer space, but you know, what about 2 inches inside? What about that journey, the journey of self-discovery? People have lost track of that. So Gita describes that particle of soul is 1/10,000th the tip of a hair in dimension. And that it's hovering in the region of the heart. The life airs are here in the heart. So it's hovering there. And because of the presence of that soul, which is described as more brilliant than 10,000 suns rising, there's consciousness throughout the body. Just like the sun is relatively small compared to the whole universe. Universe is dark. You can imagine if there was no sun or moon. Whoa. So the sun is situated in a corner of the universe and the whole universe gets lit up. The whole universe gets heat because that tiny little speck in one corner. So in the same way, the soul is situated in the region. It's very, very tiny but very powerful. And its presence can be known by consciousness. Like, oh, that hurts. Yeah, I might hit my toe. The consciousness is spread throughout the entire body. So these are interesting facts which have been available for thousands and thousands of years in the East. In India, the street sweeper knows he's not the body. He knows he's the soul within. So he just takes care, as much care of the body as necessary to keep the body and soul together. And his real purpose in life is to understand more and more that soul within. This is the difference. Their motto is simple living with high thinking. And our life is complicated life with just a little time to think, unfortunately. So with our intelligence, we can understand that particle of life, that soul within. And Krishna goes on to explain, Najayate mriyate vakadachin nayam bhutva vanabhuya. For that soul, there's never birth, nor death, nor having once been, does he ever cease to be. There's no birth. Yeah, well, man, I was born 21 years ago. What are you talking about? Well, the body was born. That's not when you started to exist, when your mom and dad, what I'm going to details. Did they create something so sophisticated as life? That was the last thing on their minds. What actually happened? By higher arrangement, the sperm and the ovum come together and they create a emulsification. And the soul took shelter in that small pea-like body, not even yet an embryo. And because of the presence of the soul, that little emulsification begins to grow. Even after a few weeks, you can see something like what looks like a body, like that. And because of the presence of the soul, it grows and it grows. Now, should the soul leave the embryo in the womb, what happens? Miscarriage. It's not that life comes about at 7 months. The chemicals and poof, consciousness, life. No. Life is there. Dead things don't grow. Only living things grow. So the presence of the soul, the embryo becomes developed, and then by nature's way, propelled out through the womb to the world, and because of the presence of the soul, the baby grows, and he becomes a young child, and he becomes a young adult, he becomes middle-aged, and he becomes old. And then one day, when this machine breaks down, the driver leaves. Voila. Le mot, death. Vous parlez français? I was just speaking in France. What is death? Death just means the soul leaves the body, just like you have a car. Perhaps a car and a driver are a better analogy than a puppet in a hand. There's a car, right? You've got the driver, and he drives it around. It's really a cool car for like a few years, and then nobody looks at it anymore, and then it gets old, and pretty soon it's an old jalopy, and then poof, poof, you drive into the car dealer and you say, it's too old, I gotta leave. You make a down payment on another car and you drive away. That's death. Death is only when the soul leaves it. He comes into the body at conception and he leaves at death. And what happens to him at death? Oh man, we don't care. That's like a long way away. Is it? Do only old people die? Don't infants, again, die in the womb? Or haven't some of your friends expired untimely, we would say? No, it's a question we have to ask ourselves. Where do we go at the moment of death? I mean, you can say in our Judeo-Christian tradition, you either go to heaven or hell, but that's kind of like a really simple answer. Like, okay, exactly, like, where do I go when I go to hell? Because I'm like a really bad guy. Or what really happens when I... You know, that's explained in Bhagavad Gita. It's like a PhD in the science of self-realization. What happens when the soul leaves the body, according to his desires at the moment of death, he takes birth again in the womb of a new mother. He gets another body, like you get another car. I'll quote Sanskrit again. Dehi nosmin yata dehe kovanam yovanam jara. As the embodied soul travels from the body of a baby to a boy to an old man, similarly the soul passes into another body at death. I was at a university the other day and I got to this point, one student stood up. Where's the proof we change our bodies at death? who's ever come back, Swami? So I said, no. Even in this lifetime, you're changing your body. You know, you can close your eyes and you remember when you were 7 or 5, and the girls had their dollies, and we boys had our guns or, you know, our fire trucks. I don't know what. I have fire trucks. You can think about that. And, you know, now it's 25 years later, 23 years later. You're the same person, but where's that 5-year-old body? In medical science, they say that every 7 years, all the cells in the body change. That's not philosophy. That's not religious dogma. That's not, you know, some... Every 7 years, all the cells in the body change. If you're 21, you've changed your body 3 times. Have you died 3 times? Have you become 3 different people? No. And one day you're going to be my age. I'm 60. One day you're going to be like me. And, you know, you're not going to look like, you know, like you are now. Believe me. Something's changing. Something's remaining the same. Something's completely changing. Something's remaining. The constant factor. The constant factor is you. You see, we're really attached to the body, but you can see, like, which body are you? The body when you were 5? The body when you were 14? The body when you're 50? Which body are you? Even if in the last hour, billions of cells have died and been replaced, you're not even the same body when you came in. But you're the same. So just as you change bodies in this life, you change bodies in death. It's logical. When spiritual knowledge is explained according to some genuine authority in a very logical and reasonable way, it's very easy to understand. Yeah, but I'll think about that later. You know, now I'm in school and I've got a whole life ahead of me. There's 2 things you have to do. Pay your taxes and you have to die. So where will you go? I mean, you cannot maybe get away with not paying your taxes. I don't know. There's a few Al Capones, but even he got caught. But what will you do when you die? It's like, you know, there's an apartment complex here, and you're settled in there with your family, and then you get a notice from the town council that they're going to tear it down and they're going to build a supermarket there or something. So you've got 6 months. So what do you do? You just hang around and do they go to work and come home and don't think about it? No. You get out the classified ads and you look. Okay, so it's available in 5 months. You make a down payment. So by the time the bulldozers come, you're ready. So life should be like that. These are certain things that, you know, should be definite. We should definitely know certain things. We should know where we're going at the moment of death. So according to your desire, you will take birth in any one of the 8,400,000 species of life. Not that we all go to the same place or even just 2 places. Just like when this program's over this evening, you're all going to go and you're going to go to many different destinations. Why? Because you have different desires. You're going to go to a restaurant. You're going to go visit a friend. You're going to go straight home and go to sleep. You're going to go to the library and, you know, work all night. So many desires. So death is like that. When you die, you may have, there's so many desires you can have in this world. And according to those desires, you're placed in a particular situation. Now, I know it sounds a little strange to you because, you know, Western society, we don't accept that the animals have a soul. But in India, they do. The animals, the birds, the fish, the insects, even the plants. Otherwise, how do you explain the consciousness that is there? Consciousness is a sign of a soul. As soon as that body is no longer conscious, then you say, oh, the person's gone. Who's gone? The body's there. No, they've gone. When the consciousness is gone, that means the soul is gone. Just like one day in a godzillion years when there's no more light, no more heat in the universe, that means the sun's extinguished. So in the same way, where there's consciousness, there's a soul. So is there not consciousness in your pet? How many of you have a pet? You have a dog or a cat or a bird. Now, are they a machine? Are they something you change the alkaline batteries, you know, 3 times a week? Oh. Meow. Oh, change the batteries. Woof, woof. Oh. Put some petrol in. You know. Not a machine. You feed it like you feed yourself. In fact, that animal, if you really, it's kind of like part of the family. I know when I was young, we'd go on vacation, we'd always take the dog because I couldn't. My father couldn't stand to leave the dog in the house while it was whimpering as we drove away. All right, Cersei, we called her. Come on. And she was the life of the party, really. I mean, she never got depressed. Or she's always wagging her tail. Not a machine. The dog eats, you eat, he sleeps, you sleep, he has sex, you fight, he fights. You feel love? You think the dog doesn't feel love? For her puppies? For you? She feels fear if you show the stick? These are not signs of a machine. They haven't created a robot that feels love or fear or emotion or has intelligence to the degree that an animal has intelligence. Of course, the lower down the evolutionary scale you go, the lesser the intelligence is there, of course. But that's just because the soul's covered more by the material energy. Like we have a light here, bright light. So that's, say, like the pure soul. Then you put a red covering, it comes out red, and a blue, it comes out darker. So the soul can go downwards to different species of life temporarily and become covered by different degrees of material consciousness. But the soul is there. Therefore, in India, they're vegetarian. They say, Vidya Vinaya Sampane Brahmani Gavi Hastini Sunichaiva Sapakicha Pandita Samdarshanaha. That a truly learned person, it doesn't matter which spiritual tradition, he can be a Christian, he can be a Muslim, he can be a Jew, a Buddhist, a Hindu, that's not the point. If he's truly fixed on his path, what he sees is the true equality of all living beings. When I was a kid, I was raised Roman Catholic, and my favorite saint in the Christian tradition to this day is Saint Francis, because he was so cool. He just like... You know, one day he said, "Hey, brother bird, sister beer, a deer, cousin squirrel." He was referring to the animals as like relatives. Why? Because he saw that all living entities are created by God. So we say, "Hey, brother, hey, sister," doesn't mean anything unless you got the same father. So as a result of that, he was strictly vegetarian. He was strictly vegetarian. They thought he was crazy. They kicked him out. They thought he was mad. He started his own church, and because he was genuine, so many followers came, and later they canonized him when they realized. So this is the vision. It's not a sectarian vision. It's just the vision of the Hindus. Any person who has this deep spiritual vision, he doesn't see the body. He sees the soul. So he loves the white man, the black man, the yellow man. He loves men and women equally. He loves the American, he loves the Canadian, the German, the Japanese, the Iraqi, the Australian. He doesn't see any difference. And no apartheid here. Apartheid means that we're better. I spent a lot of time in South Africa. That the white man's better than the black man. No, no apartheid. We're not better than any other living entity. We're just more fortunate. And when mankind loses his spirit of compassion, all creatures, he becomes degraded to the level of animals, which just fight. We have to have our shining quality is a spirit of compassion. Oh man, like what do we eat then? You know, don't you remember the American diet? Wendy's and McDonald's and, you know, steakhouse. What do you eat? Oh, there's a whole variety of foodstuffs out there. I've been vegetarian since I was 14. And I hardly ever get sick. This is my student here. I hardly ever get sick. He has to keep up with me in my advanced old age. What's the biggest animal on the earth? The elephant. What does he eat? He eats grass. You want to fight an elephant? Even if, what do they call that, mixed martial arts I saw the other day? Wow. How things have changed since I was a kid. We do judo, you know. This is like mixed martial arts, you know. Take a whole group that couldn't fight an elephant. What about a bull? Bull's very powerful. He pulls the plow, the earth, and the man. And all he asks for is a little grass. So, of course, you don't have to eat grass just to be vegetarian. There's a variety. Delicious foods, and no violence is incurred. How do you explain karma in America? I know. Live by the gun, die by the gun. Yeah. I was just in Australia. I had to come up with something there. I said, what goes around comes around. You've heard the word karma. Karma means that for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. Very like physics. You exert a certain amount of force, and then you can determine how far the object will move. So for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. If you do good, good comes back to you. If you do bad, bad comes back to you. I was in Alice Springs, and I was visiting the Aborigines. Very interesting people. I was thinking, you know, they're kind of backward. Well, I learned so much from them, because they live so close to nature, and therefore so close to God. I thought I was going to teach them. I ended up learning from them. And one man, I was trying to explain karma. He was dressed just in that cloth they wear, and old, and you know, he said, I know, karma, karma. He took his boomerang. Karma. You throw, it comes back. He said, like that? I said, yes, like that. He said, you try. Oh, my karma. I got a little scar here. So life's like that. You know, why do good things happen to bad people, or why do bad things happen to good people? This guy's been good his whole life, man. He never hurt a fly. Terrible car accident. But if you look at the whole picture, if you look that his life doesn't just mean this one spot existence in the universe, but it's going back thousands or millions or billions of lifetimes, then you can understand it's catching up with him. So there is a soul in every living creature, and the living entities, to make a long story short, the living entities transmigrate. Since we left the spiritual world, we've been transmigrating from one universe to the next, from one species of life to the next, from one body to the next. I know it sounds kind of overwhelming. Just see life like a big book and different chapters. So when one chapter ends, another chapter begins. It's good to see the bigger picture. You got to step. Sometimes we're like so involved, and just step back and see the bigger. The bigger picture is that you're eternal. There was never a time when you did not exist, nor in the future shall you ever cease to exist. But here in the material world, we're kind of like we're going like this. We're not getting anywhere. Like a dog's chasing his tail, doesn't go anywhere. We're in a constant cycle of birth, death, birth, death, birth, death, birth, death, birth, death. You know, sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad, sometimes it's in between, but at one University of Michigan, well, that same boy, he stood up. He said, okay, sounds logical, reincarnation, don't have any arguments. Just tell me how I can act in such a way that my next lifetime I'll be like Bill Gates. Like for him, that was like, you know, tops. Bill Gates. In our society, you know, you get a good education, marry a handsome man, a beautiful girl, get a good career, make money, retire in Florida. Life's perfecto. But I explained to him, I said, even if you're that 2% upper, this is a world of duality. There's happiness and distress. There's heat and cold, black and white. There's happiness and distress. There's heads and there's tails. You can't have happiness without having distress. You know why that's not good? Because the nature of that spark of life within, the nature of that force, the nature of that atma, that soul, is to always be happy. That's why even in our lives, we try to make ourselves happy and we try to avoid distress, because that's natural. We don't go for distress, we go for happiness, because the nature, like water seeks its own level. We are constantly endeavoring for happiness. No one can deny that. We're constantly endeavoring to be happy. Just like the intrinsic nature of sugar, it's sweet. The intrinsic nature of salt is it's salty. The intrinsic nature of water, it's wet. The intrinsic nature of you, besides what you see in the mirror in the morning, is to be always joyful. But the sadhus, the rishis, the yogis, they say, okay, but you're looking in the wrong place. Don't think that science and technology is going to change it. They can make life a little more comfortable. I got a good seat here. When I was in, oh yeah, you have the hard seat. I'm the teacher, I got the soft seat. So, wow. They can make life a little easier, but they'll never stop birth, they'll never stop disease, they'll never stop old age, and they won't stop death. So as whatever you can achieve, it's like a castle in the sand. It'll go one day. Of course, you need the castle in the sand. Even though we're not the body, we should take good care of the body because it's like a vehicle that can take us to a transcendental goal. But my point is just try to, my short class is just, see, there's more than just, you know, 100 years of the normal American life. Because next lifetime, where will you be? The point is that we don't want to stay in that cycle of birth and death. We've been there a long time, and we're still not satisfied. Now, if something doesn't work, after a while you say, hey, let's change it. Like, I sit down here, right, and I start speaking, the microphone doesn't work. Okay, I fiddle around with it, like that, okay, doesn't work. And then I fiddle around a little bit more, and at 5 minutes, you know. What if, like, for 1 hour I'm fiddling around with it while you're waiting for me to speak? Hello? Then 2 weeks I'm still here, and you come back next month. What's wrong with that guy? Doesn't work. Change it. So does life work? Even for the best of them. And everyone has a different idea of best. Your best may not be, you know, money. Your best may be living a simple life on a farm. But whatever it is, this is the material world. Abhrama bhuvana loka punar arvitu arjuna mamopetiti kuntiya punarjanma nividyate. Krishna says, from the highest planet in the material world down to the lowest, all are places of misery wherein repeated birth and death take place. So, that's the bad news. The good news is that there's a positive alternative. Just because you can't find water in a desert doesn't mean there's not oceans of water someplace else. And the Bhagavad Gita goes into great detail describing that transcendental realm, that spiritual world, where Krishna, we accept Krishna as the, say, the supreme personality of God. And God's not an old man, you know, with long gray hair and a beard and wrinkles and, you know, reaching out to Adam with, you know, Parkinson's disease. Like, he's the oldest, but mystically, he's the youngest. Ishvara Parama Krishna Satchidananda Vigraha Anadir Adir Govinda Sarva Karana Karana. His body is described as Nayovanamcha, ever youthful. He doesn't have a material body. This is a, why place a material concept on God? He's completely spiritual. And he has a spiritual form which is ever youthful. If you've ever seen a picture of Krishna, you must by now, you've been coming, some of you, for a couple of weeks or months. Krishna's very young. He's like teenage looking. And very beautiful and very charming. His personality is very charming. And he has his abode, and he has, which is also not subject to destruction or deterioration. He has his associates, and it's infinite. And it's all loving pastimes. It's all relating to Krishna, relating to God in different transcendental humors. Not just he's the master, but we have relationships which are more important to us than servant-master in this world. Like you have a child, or you have a friend, or you have a lover. In the Vedic philosophy, I'm going a little deep here, it's quite esoteric, but you can have the same relationship with Krishna, with God. He's your best friend, he's your most intimate lover. But I won't go further because that's quite deep. But just to give you an idea, there is a very variegated spiritual world where life's eternal, full of knowledge, and bliss. And that should be the destination of every intelligent man and woman. But, of course, we have to be realistic. We live in, 2008 in America. So we have our responsibilities to ourselves, our friends, our family, our school, our country. But the idea is, like the Chinese say, the yin and the yang. You have to find the balance. You have to find the balance between your material life and your spiritual life. For most people, spiritual life is just kind of a one-off thing. You know, they'll go once a week or a couple times a week or be involved in a project like this. But actually, and I see it in India also, but actually it should be something constant, a constant meditation. And in India, they have a very nice technique for always being in a spiritual mood, regardless if you're going to school or you're working or, you know, whatever, you're doing recreation. And that is called mantra meditation. Through sound vibration, we can always remain in a transcendental consciousness. Sound has great potency. For example, if you're listening to the radio and you turn it and you come across the blues, "She left me down and out, all alone for the third time." And you're thinking, man, it must be the same girl. You said the same thing to me. Start to cry. Sound is so powerful. It just altered your consciousness. People in the old days, I don't know society, I don't live deep within, but in the 60s, everyone was taking drugs to alter their consciousness. But look how much sound alters your consciousness. Then you turn on the light and you come across a happy song. I don't know anything about it. I spent most of my time in India, but I'll quote from my days. "Here comes the sun, na 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 na. Here comes the sun, I say, it's all right." You know, yeah, you know, Bob Marley's got those, you know, "One love." So, yeah, no matter if you're down, you feel picked up, right? Sometimes you're down, you put your iPod on, you just, okay, all right. But then you turn the radio and you come to, you know, like the news I saw today on the Dash, they had that little, said that Bush is saying that everything in Iraq is okay. You'll read it on CNN that the surge was successful and we're controlling the situation. We're handing responsibility over, but we're going to keep our boys there another 10 years. Wah! You know, because I don't know what side you're on. I'm very careful here. By the way, I was in the Marine Corps for 2 years, so I did my duty. Anyway, how did a Marine become a monk? Well, it's a long story. You can read it on my website. I've been through heaven and hell, so that's in a summary. But you become a little angry. So what is it? It's just sound. It's just sound. It affects you. So the Vedas say that by sound we become conditioned. I am the body. I am American. I'm Canadian. I'm a fisherman. I'm a banker. You're all those things for a few years, and then you change and you change. And try to understand who you really are. So there are sounds that come from the transcendental realm, which wake up the soul. Now the soul is kind of like an automatic pilot. He's going along, okay, I'm American, all right. We're thinking like that. But this sound is more powerful than the blues, than jazz, than classic, than heavy metal. It's more subtle and refined. And what it does is it wakes you up spiritually. And you begin to see things as they are, as you hear from these ancient scriptures, as you hear from a spiritual master, you see for yourself. And you become very peaceful, because this world, there's a lot of stress in this world. Like I deal a lot with young people, they say, "I'm so stressed out." I say, "Well, wait till you get to be 40. "Oh, you mean it doesn't finish when I graduate from school?" No, at every stage there's a certain set of problems, believe me. I'm just going into the autumn of my life. The whole, you know, my knees, you know, my digestion, my hearing, you know, I never expected it. But like this, you can be a little bit above it all. You're there, you're responsible, but you're a little aloof. Like I remember in the Bible it says, Jesus said, to be in this world, but not of this world. And in India we have the lotus flower. And the lotus flower is growing in the lake, and the stem is going into the mud, but the flower itself is just a little bit above the water. So you can say it's in the water, but it's not touching. So you can remain in a spiritual consciousness, a transcendental consciousness. It doesn't mean you're like foggy and like spaced out. But you're seeing things with knowledge. Here's a soul. You're seeing the workings of nature, birth, disease. You don't become overly happy and unnecessarily depressed. Because you know how things are working. When you see people happy, hey, you have some good karma. Use it in a spiritual way. You see someone suffering, sorry, that's your karma from something previous. Just tolerate, like the summer and winter seasons, they're temporary, they go away, everything will be all right in time, time heals all wounds. You see things with knowledge, so you don't engage in those activities which bring, you know, such bad results, like physically and mentally, intellectually. Like in Krishna consciousness, we're vegetarian, we don't take any intoxication, we don't take drugs, we don't drink liquor, we don't smoke, we don't take coffee or tea, anything that would affect this body which we're not, this machine, my BMW. Don't put your hand on my BMW. My BMW. It's not you. You're not the. I know, but it's going to drive me to the. So, like that, you're very careful not to hit the microphone into your tooth. You're very careful not to put anything in your body which would affect this opportunity for self-realization. And here's the one that's going to be the hardest for you to accept. No sex outside of marriage. And in marriage, mostly for the procreation of a child. Oh man, you guys, that's enough. I'm out of here. You guys are living in the Victorian age. Well, we don't say no sex, because sex is something very beautiful. But sex has a purpose, and that no one's going to deny this. Sex is ultimately meant to conceive. We take prophylactics, whatever, to stop that. But nature's way is that it conceives. So in India, they'll conserve that energy. And then when they conceive, they're in a divine consciousness. They're thinking spiritual things. You know, they'll have read the books and they'll have chanted or meditated before they conceive. So what happens is a very elevated soul takes birth. It's not by chance. Nothing happens by chance. Not a blade of grass moves without the will of the Supreme. So the child you conceive is due to the mentality you had. He had when he died, and you have when you conceive. It's a science which has been lost. Even in India, but there are generations in India, families, but generation after generation, the children are very spiritually elevated. I've met them. It's very unique. So that's why they control the sex desire, so that at the moment of conception, because you have to live with that kid for the rest of your life. You forget, oh man, the sex was great, but look at this little rascal. He's terrible twos. He's 22. He's still terrible. You know, but this is the science. And also, the sex desire is really what conditions us to this world. It's kind of like a perverted form of the love we have for God. Instead of God, we love matter. The body of a woman or the body of a man. I love you. I love everything about you. Do you love my pancreas? Do you love my kidneys? You know, an enlightened girl would say, you can't love me unless you know who I am. And I'm not this body, sir, I'm the soul. So become self-realized and you can be my boyfriend. So if you can conserve that energy, the yogis, you know, the hatha yogis, because we're bhakti yogis, the hatha yogis, they take that drive and they dovetail it and they move the kundalini, they move the energy up to the mind where they can think deeply about these subject matters and focus on spiritual life. So, no illicit sex and no gambling. Like, how do you guys do it? I mean, you're American and, you know, don't do that. I haven't done these things since I was 18. How is it possible? One sage, he said, you can only give up something if you get something better. So the test that you're really practicing your spiritual tradition, and I know that most of you are Christian, or maybe some of you are Buddhists, or you're yogis or seekers, but if you truly follow that path, what will happen is that the experience you get will be far superior to anything in this world. Far superior. Param Vishnu Nivartante, Krishna says, the yogi, the transcendentalist, he's fixed in his way of life because he's enjoying an inner peace, an inner joy, which far exceeds, you know, Coors beer, or this or that, or marijuana, or whatever. Those things are all kind of cheap thrills. They just take the tension off. But why not go higher and higher and higher in a transcendental way and never come down? As we used to say in my generation, stay high forever. So that's done through sound. we follow those principles, we live a simple life. I mean, I'm kind of an exception because I'm a monk, but you know, I have just what I carry for the last 36 years. I just have a little bag, this is, by the way, the mark of a renounced monk in India. He carries a bamboo stick like that. But I just carry whatever I have. I get by. I've gotten by for the last 30 some odd years. But if you're, you know, married, like my students, marries a very beautiful Russian wife, and they're planning a family, so he has more possessions. But, you know, take what you need. Gandhi said, the problem in the world today is people are taking, not according to their need, they're taking to their greed. That creates an imbalance. You have the haves and the have-nots, and what it does is it pollutes the environment. The whole environmental issue could be solved by going back to a simple way of life, because by God's arrangement, there's enough for everybody in this world. But because we can't get enough, I can't get no satisfaction. Mick Jagger's still singing the same stupid song 40 years later. You can't get full satisfaction. That's when you go within. So our process, as you know, you were doing it even before I came, I was so surprised. Our sound vibration to awaken that sleeping soul and to understand all these things, that sound vibration is Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. That same boy, gosh, he said to me, he said, but Swami, it's just three words. How could all the solution to all the problems of life? I said, nice things come in small packages. I mean, you look on the Pentium chip. What's so much is on there? So imagine how much is in this transcendental sound vibration. So you can experiment. You don't have to change. You don't even have to follow those principles I was mentioning. If you chant this sound vibration, wherever you go, on the way to work, or if you're at school, or in the shower, if you chant, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, you will definitely experience a dawn of awakening. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.